Gorsley, Mother. Come on, Gorsley.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories, y'all.
Get involved in the show. We are the story guys at gmail.com, like our friend Penton. He writes the show and says, hey, I remember hearing about Godsmack and Story of the Year being in an alleged beatdown back in the day. Is there any truth to that? Yeah. I feel like this is solely my territory. Mm-hmm. Do you know who Story of the Year is?
Yes, absolutely. I learned about them from doing this podcast was coming up, and I needed to have some study materials.
Hey, listen, learn. No fault. If you don't know who Story of the Year is, I assume you know who Godsmack is.
And I know who Goldfinger is.
Okay.
I got that.
There's a Goldfinger connection to Story of the Year. We're definitely going to get there. Okay, so good. Short answer, if you do not know who Story of the Year is, third wave emo band. Listeners of the show may or may not know that I have this association with an emo scene in our hometown. And so this is like my bread and butter. And I feel like this might be the spot on this show. I've been having a lot of wins lately. I got to do the Third Eye Blind episode. I feel like now this might be the episode where I get to explain the waves of emo. Are you good with that?
I automatically feel guilt again. Have I made it?
No, we've just never really gotten into emo. I mean, I think we will. You know, there's definitely stories to tell in that genre. We haven't really gotten there yet. So this is the first foray. I'm excited to do this, though. What other scenes and styles of music have had waves?
By the way, I just want to say, I would never have trouble talking about my feelings. Ever. Sorry, what was your question you want to ask me about?
Waves of music. What other scenes have had waves?
You know, in terms of like how this is laid out, no one like this. There's like the new wave of British heavy metal. Pop music.
That's accurate. Well, yeah, new wave pop music probably doesn't correlate. But like
post-punk.
The new wave of British heavy metal would be a second wave. So that sort of makes sense. I like that.
Right. But in terms of the complexity of the, however I guess you would put it together, nothing's like this.
Okay, but before we get to the waves, what exactly is emo? I had to explain this recently.
Sure.
How do you explain it to people?
Yeah.
I feel like too close to it to try to explain it.
And I feel weird explaining it. It's like I'm explaining Publisher's Clearinghouse to a millennial. You know, it's just so weird to have to sort of do it. It's just strange. But here's what it is. So the musical styles could come and go and change or whatever, but it's the confessional lyrics.
So and there's like a theatrical component to it.
Yeah, it's more dramatic.
Okay. So give us an example of what it is and what it isn't.
It's less "you make me rock hard, baby, all night, love's like a glove, it fits just right." It's more, "I'm not okay."
Did you just put Kiss lyrics into this episode?
Whose lyrics did you think? Who else do you think wrote that? That's awful, terrible garbage.
This is a fantastic point you're making here, right? About how this all, it sort of contrasts. But if we're talking about the formation, it starts in 1984, Washington, D.C., Rites of Spring, Dag Nasty, Embrace. They're these bands that come out of hardcore music, right? But their lyrics are a little more self-reflective. And I feel like this might be the, if there is a wave that you relate to, this is probably the wave you relate to.
Yeah, because I grew up, I guess 18-ish or whatever, I started listening to Fugazi, and this was pre.
Yeah, so this is Discord Records, right?
Yeah, okay. So I just am following the record label, and I'm following all of these bands.
So from there, it spreads into the Midwest, and it becomes more of an answer to post-hardcore, so it gets more melodic, there's a little more noodling, you know, that sort of stuff, a little more mathy, as I like to call it. Sunny Day Real Estate, Cap and Jazz, American Football, they're all part of this wave. This is like the mid-90s. Did you get into any of those bands?
Vaguely.
Okay.
That's me trying not to say no.
And at the end of the decade, where these former forms were reacting to different types of hardcore, there becomes this movement that's sort of reacting and taking the tenets of that, but putting it up against the pop punk of bands like Green Day and Blink-182, etc. And they're injecting their songs with this confessionalism again. So this is where you get Jimmy Eat World. This is where you get Brand New. My Chemical Romance will come along in this phase. And you also get bands like St. Louis, Missouri's Story of the Year. So how did I do? That was pretty impressive, right?
I think for our listeners, there's going to be some people that are like, I learned something today. Like, it's the end of the episode.
Thank you. Thank you. That's what I hope happens. Yeah. Okay, so it's important that we do this because I do think that there's an element to this story that can be attributed maybe to scenes. And I'm curious, you know, even though Story of the Year is literally and figuratively more muscular than a lot of emo bands, they get in this grouping. And we're going to talk about how this comes up against a music that is kind of termed more masculine at the turn of the century.
Yeah, yeah. But as this music rises, gets more and more popular, these bands start getting billed with more traditional rock bands.
Right, right, right.
So this is where we get to Godsmack.
And Godsmack gets lumped into several categories. I hear them as, like, how do you think of them?
They're a new metal band for me. Okay,
it's not that new metal-y. Like, you also have sort of like general radio rock thing to them. They're very embraced by rock radio, modern rock. I hear them described that way. Sometimes people will be crude and call it butt rock. I do not like that terminology. Really, though, if third wave emo is responding to pop punk, I mean, Godsmack in a lot of ways is responding to grunge.
Right, and the easy comparison early on is Alice in Chains.
Outspoken influence of theirs. They like them. They name themselves after something, after a term. You know, Godsmack is a term that gets used by Alice in Chains, and so a lot of times people think that's where they get the name from, even though they'll say it's not. And so this illustrates the dichotomy, right? So we have, you know, we've talked about grunge before. Episode 187. Quick refresh. Grunge is outwardly focused. It's angry, but it's outward. So it's the world, right? The world is a vampire. The world sucks. This is terrible. Emo, on the other hand, is angry and upset, but it's more focused inward. I'm terrible. I'm not right. I'm not okay. Something's not working. Way more in the feels.
Right. But you can see how different people participating in these scenes have different worldviews because not everyone's the same.
Right. So how much do you think scenes in music... Now, I know that, like, there's music scenes, for sure. But I mean, like, because I like country, I don't listen to rock. Or because you're goth and I'm punk, we don't talk to each other. Like, those stereotypes. In 2024, in the age of streaming, how much do you think that still exists?
I think that's dead in terms of genres of music. I think that tribalism from a personal standpoint and how people spend time socially, I think tribalism for life like never dies.
Right. It manifests in different ways, but it may not be as connected to the music scenes.
Yeah, yeah, where music, that's, you know, and when you think about it, it's really interesting. Like, if you think about music festivals, like early music festivals, or even as like mid, like Woodstock 99, like those aren't one music genre.
Right.
You know, so they've been, at some point it's been chipping away at that, and it's like the tribalism is what keeps people from being with other people.
Right.
So maybe it's commercial enterprise is what.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, right. We haven't talked about the capitalism of it all, but to not get too distracted, I do think that where this story takes place 20 years ago, and so I think it's at the beginning days of the internet and how the internet becomes a tool for music and music proliferation and scenes sort of melting into each other. I think it would be different to go to a radio music festival that has both Godsmack and Story of the Year. I don't think you would blink at that now. No, not now. And no. 20 years ago, it's a little bit strange, and that becomes part of this whole story, right? Right. So, I like I said, I keep emphasizing partly scenes for that conversation, but I'm also bringing them up because we're going to find out that this conflict that we're going to discuss actually happens between the actual band members of Story of the Year, but just people associated with Godsmack. The band members in Godsmack do not actually participate in the physical altercation.
And what we haven't mentioned is there's a 15-year gap.
Oh, age gap.
Ages between the two.
Dude, fantastic point. Because I do think you have to point that out. Generationally, these guys are coming from slightly different places. Though they both start around 95, but they start at very different phases in their life, right? So the guys in Story of the Year are trying to make this band work called Big Blue Monkey, and they're like in high school, maybe? Middle school, even?
Clearly, because they have a band called Big Blue Monkey. Sorry.
It's all one word. Yeah. That's a clear sign. Yeah. But then Sully Erna is a guy who's been playing drums in bands for like close to 10 years or something or more. And he decides he wants to get out from behind the drum kit. and be a front man. And so he starts this band called Godsmack.
Right. They have one of those 90s storybook rises to fame, for sure. So they self-produce a record, okay. And it's the DJ at night scenario. It's like Flagpole Sitta. It's like one of those...
Oh, so a rock and roll DJ in their town hears it.
Right. And so they were selling this record, like 50 records a month, and then they're selling them out of the bedroom, and so they start selling thousands of records they can't keep up.
I think they're like consigning them through Newbury Comics or something. Because out of Boston, that's how they end up doing it. Because
that's so amazing.
Yeah.
And then they get a deal with the largest record label in the world, Universal.
That's 1998. And they get pretty quickly embraced by heavy music. By 99, they're playing Woodstock. And they get on Ozzfest. They tour Europe with
Black Sabbath.
That's amazing to me. So again, heavy metal street cred, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. For sure. Another thing we should talk about, because remember we talked about Tom Waits and Doritos?
Oh, yeah.
So they two of their songs on their second big record that was called Awake get used by the U.S. Navy. So again...
Associations here, for sure. Yeah. Very masculine.
Right, right. And in 2004, they get to open up for freaking Metallica on the St. Anger tour. And that's like that's Summer Sanitarium.
How have we got Kiss and Metallica in the first 10 minutes of this conversation?
Because we do dope shit on our dope podcast, Brian. That's why.
Okay, so let's talk about Story of the Year. So, yes, Godsmack has this great storybook, Rise to Fame. Story of the Year has one, too. It's just different. They're in St. Louis trying to make this band work for a long time, and basically the best break they have for most of a decade is that they get on, they build some local following, and they get to play Point Fest, which is still a music festival that still exists. I think they've been doing it for like 30 years now, but the Point in St. Louis, a rock and roll radio station, puts it on every year.
They've been really hustling trying to make it work, so they see all these other bands that are on the bill, and that's where they see Goldfinger.
Yeah, and if you remember much about Goldfinger, they have always had a sense of humor. Here in My Bedroom's hilarious. There's a song on that same record that's something about my shower sounds like it needs to pee or something. They're comical.
They had funny songs.
They had fun. And so these guys in Big Blue Monkey come up with this plan. They make a video where they're essentially ripping off Jackass. This would be in the very early days of Jackass. And I guess they include music and stuff too. They would have had to. But they sneak onto Goldfinger's bus and leave the VHS tape. So I love this. The gumption that takes.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, they get a phone call. It's Goldfinger's manager, and he says, "What do you guys think about touring with Goldfinger?"
"I'm Mark from Big Blue Monkey, and this is Jackass." So John Feldman is the singer. He's the lead singer at Goldfinger.
Oh, love that guy.
And so he becomes an important part of Third
He's
Wave.
Huge to this. I don't know. Yeah. Did you know this?
Nah.
It kind of doesn't happen in a lot of the ways that it happened, Third Wave, without Feldman.
Right. I didn't know this, and it was super interesting for me. So it's a great example of how Third Wave comes out of pop punk. So yeah, while he's on tour with Story of the Year, he tells the guys he wants to produce them and find a record deal. And so it finds out he works out a deal with Madonna's record label.
Yeah, Maverick Records has asked him to find them bands.
Which the Deftones are still on. Since they signed their first record.
John ends up working with them and building a stronger demo than what they had been shopping. And then he gets them in front of the right people, and they do end up getting the deal that they want.
That's right. And another fun coincidental commonality between the two bands, Story of the Year lead singer Dan Marsala was originally the drummer.
Okay. And here's another fun connection to Story of the Year. Fast forward 20 years, John Feldman is still friends with the guys in Story of the Year.
Yes.
And now when he goes out and tours as Goldfinger, he takes Mike Herrera from My Boys MXPX, and he takes Phil from Story of the Year, and they're his backing band.
Right. And so it was a great idea to leave that VHS tape on the bus.
It worked out.
So once John has a hold of them, the label does label magic, and they're now on the Warped Tour before they have a single even out.
Yep.
So the single hits, it's called Until the Day I Die, and it'll peak just shy of the top 10 on the alternative Billboard charts at the end of the summer of 2003.
And they get to open for Linkin Park. Think about 2003 Linkin Park. This is a big deal. That's the winter of 2004, like January, February. And suddenly now, as the spring is turning into summer in May of 2004, they get to play a radio station festival. They're at this point in their career where the record labels are making deals with radio stations to get them more airplay. And part of that will go along in the post days of Paola is, hey, come play our radio station concert so we can, you know, funnel a bunch of fans and everybody makes money. And so they, just like they had sneaked onto Goldfinger's bus 2 years ago at a radio station festival, now they are the arguably like the second headliner at this radio festival in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Yeah, if I can do the radio big guy voice.
Yeah.
By the big guy voice is the voice guy you hear who does all the station stuff. So here's my big guy voice. X-103 in Indianapolis presents Mayday, Godsmack, Story of the Year, Smile, Empty Soul, and Breaking Benjamin.
Now, immediately you can see the Story of the Year is a little bit of an outlier on this. They look
like they're also the second headliner-ish.
I know, so they're way up there, but all of those other bands, Breaking Benjamin, Smile, Empty Soul, Godsmack, they're heavier, they're darker, they're definitely more angry at the world as opposed to angry at themselves, if we're going to do all this. To illustrate the point that I've been attempting to prove this entire episode, let me start this whole story by jumping to the end and having you read a response left on a message board back in 2004 after this happens. The username of this person who posted this is
In Flames Freak,
which I have to assume is a reference to the band In Flames, which, let's just let the record show, way heavier of a rock band than Godsmack or Story of the Year, for sure.
So here's the message on the board from In Flames Freak. You ready? Okay, one thing is Story of the Year sucks ass and shouldn't have been able to play in that concert. Second of all, Godsmack doesn't suck. I hope Godsmack and their crew taught you a lesson. And if you didn't, I hope they pound you face into the ground, you stupid assholes. Seriously, I mean, I hate these new bands that are coming out making fun of bands that are better and have been out a lot longer than they have been. Just like Darkness saying Disturbed isn't a good band. They're better than you, you stupid British fuck. Wow. Thanks. I'm glad I got to read that.
You know what I wish? I wish I could say right now. Remember when message boards were terrible and people were ugly on the internet, and now that doesn't happen anymore?
Mm.
No. 20 years later, that problem has not been fixed.
No.
That comment's not incredibly relevant to any of this, but it does serve as this illustration of this heavy music fan base deciding arbitrarily at the time who belongs and who doesn't. I like that the guy's response is like, not only does Story of the Year suck, but while I'm here, let me tell you about how I hate the Darkness.
Yeah. They stink too.
A lot of the message board reaction is very anti-Story of the Year, but let's talk about what happened.
And there's two ways to tell the story. What happened, and then what happened afterwards. And well, let's just skip to the aftermath.
I think we have to really tell this story. And we'll get, like, at the end, we'll sort of get to why we have to tell it this way. But basically, the day after this music festival, what is about to be read gets posted on Story of the Year's website. Again, 2004. So bands basically just had MySpace and then their own website. They didn't have Facebook and stuff, right?
So I'm going to read this. You can read the whole thing. It's in the show notes. It is a full 2 pages, so I'm just going to give you the highlights.
And this is Story of the Year, a band member of Story of the Year posting this.
Fuck Godsmack and their Nazi fucking crew. Hello, everyone. Something pretty amazing happened. I'd like to share it with you. Last night at a radio show in Indiana, my band, except for Josh, he was in the shower. Thanks for pointing that out. And our tour
mental image much.
And our tour manager was jumped by Godsmack's production manager, crew, and security, along with local security. It was a pretty fair fight. The five of us versus at least 10 200-pound football reject jock cokehead fucking pieces of shit fucking losers. Almost a fair fight, huh? So what did we do to deserve this, you're probably wondering. It had to be something really bad, huh? Do we have sex with one of their wives? No, that's not why. I love it. This is great.
He's so mad, and he's just stream of consciousness writing, and this is what comes out.
Did we steal some of their drugs? No, not that either. Did we sell their security some bunk steroids? No. This is the awful thing that we did to get jumped. The show was in an amphitheater. We made everyone in the crowd jump and asked everyone in the lawn to come down to the front.
Here is
of the
what
stage.
They really did. This is what they really did. They downplay this.
Okay. I can totally understand how this might have caused a little bit of panic for local security, but mm-hmm. the show was sucking, so we had to make it rock. Thanks for making that clear. It's not like there was a riot or anything. It ruled. Apparently, Godsmack's douchebag fucking production manager and crew didn't like us, so they were backstage waiting for us.
Okay. There's plenty more, but pause here for a moment. Let's just recap and process this. First, let me ask you this. Have you ever been to this amphitheater?
I guess so, right? Yes, I have.
I know. I'm pretty sure this is the amphitheater where our producer Troy told us that he saw Nine Inch Nails once in the rain.
Yeah,
I like that story. I think that's in a bonus episode somewhere.
And I think he and I... No, I thought we saw Black Sabbath. Maybe it was another amphitheater.
So I was there last night.
To see... Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I saw Third Eye Blind in this venue yesterday.
Yeah.
And it is one of those things where, like, it's pretty standard if you know kind of the current amphitheater layout of the last 20 years or so, where you've got the seated pavilion that's undercover, and then behind it, up sort of raised on a hill, you have a lawn, right?
Yeah.
And so because this is a radio show, I think if they were not GA tickets all the way around, they're encouraging people to break basically ticketing protocol. And this is seated. Having been there yesterday, I can tell you it's seated all the way up, at least now. 20 years ago, maybe it wasn't.
Yeah.
But there's no pit area. So there's seats all the way up to the stage. So you're encouraging people from the back to move to the front, which obviously is going to make security pretty nervous.
Which means, just to too long didn't read, if you've got tickets in the grass, you sit on your ass.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you have a tickets in the seat.
Okay, so back to this point, the story of the year put on their website, and then we'll talk further about this, but go back to this post.
Yeah, because there's more and it's not done. I'm going to stop the story right there just to reiterate the fact that this was a radio show, all caps, not a fucking Godsmack show.
All caps.
We are not opening for Godsmack.
Now, so there's some posturing here for sure.
Yeah, and we are not on tour with Godsmack is definitely posturing.
All right, fair enough.
The absolute fact of the matter is that neither Godsmack's band or crew had any authority or say in anything regarding my band. It was simply none of their fucking business what happened on or off the stage during our performance. It's funny that the only people in the whole fucking ordeal that were cool was the damn radio station.
Hell
no,
yeah.
One from WRZX. Look, he even does the call letters. Thank goodness.
It's 2004, man.
Said anything to us. Plus, they didn't jump us.
Radio station people being dope.
I know.
That checks out. I love it.
It checks out. Okay, so there's more. The story's great. Anyway, we walked off the stage excited because we turned a shitty show into a fucking rock show. Within 10 seconds of us finishing our last song, Godsmack's... The adjectives change. Ugly dick face production manager.
We have the explicit advisory on this episode, right? I sure hope we do, and I apologize for those of you offended by the language here.
Hey, by the way, warning everyone, not safe for work language. Godsmack's ugly dick face production manager had his hands all over Dan, screaming at him, saying, "Get the fuck out of here. You're not getting fucking paid. Who the fuck do you think you are? You're not fucking rock stars." Dan replied to the guy's face, "Yeah, rock and roll." This really pissed off the piece of shit production manager. Our tour manager intervened and told the dude not to touch band members. What happens next? Three Cro-Magnon jock fucks grab our tour manager and hold him still so one guy could pummel his face. Four of them jump on Adam and pummel his face. Dan, Phil, and I got hit, but not half as bad as they did. Josh walked off stage and went into the dressing room just 5 seconds before this happened and missed it. I did get to punch a dude in the face a couple of times. I like how he just wants to say, man, I did get a couple in.
Read the next sentence.
Right? That ruled. Dan got to punch their production manager in the face, and Phil, God love Phil, he picked up a metal box and smashed the... I'm not saying that
Don't
word.
Don't say it.
Face production manager in the head with it. I think it's pretty safe to say we lost, though.
This is wild stuff.
And also, God, how crazy you just post all that stuff on your website.
Okay, so I this is a part of the story that I think
there's no publicist
we have to talk about, which is how different media was at the time. Honestly, now it would not be very surprising to me that somebody loses their mind on Twitter and goes on a Twitter rant. And yeah, a lot of people are getting this under control. But in the last 5 or 6 years, right, we saw a lot of this. In 2004, everyone's still trying to figure out how the internet works, kind of, right? Facebook is still on college campuses only. And, like, we haven't fully gotten to this right level of social media where, like, constantly we're content creators and we're putting things out when we're entertainers. And so the idea that they decided, hey, we're going to take this to the internet is interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then how they do it, their only really place to do it, I don't think they understand or feel the power of MySpace at that point. And so they do it on their website. So these guys have access to their own website.
Yeah.
It sounds like there was no middle person.
No.
Doing this.
No. Did you hear what I just read? No. There's no middle person.
I'm like, Universal Republic did not give you a publicist? Well, maybe they did. We're going to get to that part of the story unless, in just a second.
Unless it was Story of the Year's motherfucking production manager, and that's what he called him.
So the big point that he keeps making in this diatribe, and we'll go on reiterating, is that he thinks the offense being felt by Godsmack is that Story of the Year is trying to overshadow them. And they keep saying this is a radio festival and not a traditional show.
And then, according to their story, cops show up and quarantine Story of the Year in a backstage room and don't do anything to the other guys. And quote,
it doesn't get better, people.
An inbred cop with a handlebar mustache tells us he's not putting up with our kind and the whole thing's a joke and he can personally guarantee that nothing will happen to anyone that kicked our ass.
I like how this turns into a time to kill. Like, we're suddenly in, yeah, in the deep antebellum South. I don't know what's happening.
We're quarantining you boys to a concrete room. It's got no windows. That is a weird thing to say.
There are a few more paragraphs and a lot more name calling and profanity that we're cutting out. I know you're like, there could be more. How is this possible?
Yeah.
But you get the point. And it should be pointed out that at the time they post photos. So again, back to this idea of leveraging the power of the internet. They think, hey, hold on, man. And they go, they don't have camera phones probably. And if they do, they're, you know, not going to do high-res photos. So maybe they go get a camera? I don't know how this works. But they take photos of the freshly fucked up faces, and they put them on their website as well, which might be the craziest part of the story to me. Now, if you click these links, you can still find these links, but they're all dead, because Maverick owns the rights to storyoftheyear.com, and they just took it down. Like, it is all gone.
Yeah.
Only dead links.
I'll just reiterate here in case anybody just decided to skip ahead in the episode. Not safe for work language before this.
So there is a version of this story where the concern is not ego, right? Where the concern is safety. And the more I read over this stuff, the more I think that's what the guys in Story of the Year are not getting about any of this. He mentions it kind of in passing, like, oh, do they think we caused a riot or something? We didn't cause a riot.
Right.
But we should talk about this for a moment because, okay, first I'll just say, I think it's believable that that's the real concern because they say so many security guys, both from Godsmack and locally, are involved, right? So people are like, listen, you are making our jobs hard. So that's part of it. We've also spent enough time recently on the show talking about what a nightmare can happen when crowds get out of control.
Yeah.
So you do not want the performers provoking that. And if they really are asking people to jump barriers or take over other people's assigned seats, etc., you're encouraging anarchy, and that is not a good situation for anybody, and it is very unsafe. And if these people are supposed to be the guardians of safety for thousands of people, I understand why they're upset.
Yeah. And absolutely, and sorry to sound like old people and saying, like, you shouldn't do those things. It's dangerous. So here's my favorite. Here's my favorite Rush the Stage story, and it was awesome. So I had to look it up, and it was, I saw Lollapalooza 94, and Green Day was on it.
They were out of control.
And they were opening, and it was either like 1 to 2 nights before they played Woodstock 94. So it was right before that happened. So they open up with Welcome to Paradise, and people just kind of start to take off. But there's one guy that's ahead of everybody, and he's climbing this wall. And we're in Atlanta. No, we're in Charlotte. I'm sorry. We're in Charlotte, and there's a wall where the seats are under the shed. And there's a security guard, and he's up on top of it. And the kid punched the security guard in the face and knocks him off the wall. And then everyone started to run.
Oh, and, my God.
And so, and that was the first time I'd seen that many people take off. And I was like, I'm going to stay right here, man.
Dude, there's a lot. If you want to get into it and you follow the rise of Green Day through those first few years, it is crazy. I think there's a couple of books I've referenced on the show before. Smash by Ian Winwood. And Dan, I think Dan Ozzie in Sellout talks about, has a chapter on Green Day. Maybe, maybe not. But there's a lot about their rise and how anarchic all their shows are and how they sort of encourage that stuff and what happens. So I don't know that you've, I think you've told me that, but I don't think I've put it in the right context. That's crazy. So back to the story. Story of the year. They post this statement / freak out on their website. And what happens next? Well, it breaks wide. And then, as you often see, even now in 2024, when somebody accidentally publishes something on the internet, and regrets it, the post disappears.
This is a really good beef, though.
So digging around, I did find some reporting from the Dallas Music Guide done in the weeks after the incident. They go to talk to Adam Russell. This is the band member who makes the original post.
Yeah.
And right. He has a lot to share. And read how he explains the post getting taken down.
Yeah, so here's from that article. We took it down more for politics and trying to smooth everything over. Although we wanted the story out, since we put that thing out, all hell broke loose. Sponsors for the upcoming tour were freaking out, like, oh my God, is this going to happen again? The programmer at the radio station in Indianapolis, where it happened, was totally pissed.
And they were cool at first, remember? Yeah. They got a good write-up initially.
But now, screw those guys. Because Ryan had referred to it as a horrible new metal show or something like that.
Ouch.
So he was kind of bummed, and the news was out. That post had been copied onto like four other web pages, so he just went ahead and took it down. The cat was out of the bag.
In 2004, spreading virally meant four other websites.
Yeah, it just got, someone just took the code and put it on some other place.
Again, they're mad about the phrase horrible new metal. Yeah. So again, there's this scene collision.
There's the tribalism, yeah. Weirdness, right? In this interview, Adam goes on to double down on the whole assertion that this was a radio festival and not a Godsmack show. And he gets asked about whether or not the band will pursue legal action against those dudes.
Here's that quote. We could have, had the cops not been complete morons. We're back to these cops. But the cops quarantined us in our dressing room and wouldn't let us go out and find these guys and identify them. They were all just walking around, and then they kind of disappeared, including the video of the whole incident. Wait, what? The video of the whole incident? So just when you think this guy is backing off of everything, he throws more dynamite into it all. Someone was videotaping it. Apparently Godsmack obtained the video somehow. It wasn't anyone in their crew that was filming, as far as I know. I want to see it just to look pathetic. I think it's hilarious. This is Adam Russell talking. Personally, I just want to avoid all the legal stuff.
Well, I just want to say that I know what happens next, and I can't wait to talk about it. So, but I can't believe, for me, maybe because I'm a rock guy, like, this is a better beef than the Drake Kendrick Lamar thing. I mean, the time is so, it's such a different time. The fact that such MySpace was a thing.
A different time.
Now what happens?
So he puts a bow on this in this interview by challenging Godsmack's crew to a cage match for charity.
Yeah. So, but here's the quote from him talking about that. There are three guys on our management team. One is 6'2", 350, a huge dude. One is a world champion kickboxer, heavyweight. He's like 6'6". He's a giant. This other guy is huge too. The point is, They've challenged any three members of Godsmack's band, crew, or management to a UFC-style cage match, with all proceeds going to charity to wrong the right basically. They put it out in an official press release. Sully from Godsmack was actually on the line with a couple of DJs from K-Rock the other day, and they brought it up. He just kind of shuddered and didn't answer the question.
So this all happens 20 years ago, and the internet has only held on to bits and pieces of this story. But that said, the best I can tell is that Godsmack's camp basically ignores the whole thing in the aftermath. I can find very little in the original or archived reporting that has any response from them. All this to say, from a PR and reputation standpoint, which is something you and I have worked in professionally, they nail it. They make the right move in a lot of ways, if you ask me, by staying quiet. Because regardless of what you think about this whole thing, Story of the Year comes off looking frantic at best.
Yeah, right.
And shitty at worst.
Yeah, and Godsmack kind of comes off like a bunch of mob bosses, and they just don't talk, don't say anything.
They come off like people who have good PR folks and right. good lawyers
yeah.
who are like, here's what you do, shut the hell up, let us handle
keep
this.
Keep your mouth shut.
I did find a message board post buried in the back hallways of the interwebs that offers a much more well-rounded view of this situation that I think is worth exploring. So will you read that?
Yes, I will, Brian. This comes from a 2004 post from a person using the screen name Linkalicious. Been waiting to say this all the whole podcast. On killermovies.com.
I don't know what that website is.
So that's
this seems to hold up. We're entering it as evidence. We don't know if it's 100% accurate.
It's similar to the Drudge Report in terms of movies. I'm just kidding. I have no idea. So take it what it's worth, right? Okay, so here's the post. So I heard on the radio today that earlier this week in Indianapolis, a bunch of bands were booked to perform at a radio station's event. Well, the band Story of the Year was scheduled to play earlier in the day and later in the afternoon or evening. Godsmack was supposed to play a session.
Apparently at this outdoor venue, there were the higher priced seats closer to the stage and then the ever popular lawn section. So when Story of the Year went on stage during the day, apparently no one was in the nice seats, but the lawn was packed with people. This made the lead singer and the rest of the band feel uncomfortable because their closest fans were still 50 to 75 yards away from them. So in a gesture to liven things up, the lead singer of Story of the Year announced that he would like everyone to move in closer to the nice seats instead of staying back on the lawn. This created a riot of people rushing to get to the best seats. Basically a stampede of people that were willing to stop at nothing to get their butts on a real seat instead of the grass. This starts to sound more like your Green Day story.
Right. And so that overwhelmed security at the event, and some people got hurt. After the performance, the singers and the tour manager for Story of the Year were confronted by some of the roadies and private security members of Godsmack. They were none too happy with Story of the Year for creating such a riot before they play. Some things were said to escalate the situation, and the final result was 10 huge guys from Godsmack's security personnel beat the crap out of 4 band members and 1 tour manager of Story of the Year. In response to this, the owner of the record company and his best friend, Ultimate Fighter, Jiu-Jitsu Master, threw out a challenge to any of 2 members from Godsmack's entourage, I wish I could say how entourage is spelled correctly here, to fight in a UFC-style match. Winner apologizes for their actions or something like that. Eventually, this challenge was turned down, and the lead singer of Godsmack was reported to have a tap of the altercation.
I think it's supposed to be tape.
I was like, a tape of the altercation. He claims that one member of the entourage single-handedly beat up all 5 of them. I love how this story turned into like a Schwarzenegger movie. And the other 9 or so guys are just standing around. Apparently, Godsmack and their representatives were very unhappy because they initially confront Story of the Year to tell them that a pregnant lady was trampled in the stampede they created. And the lead singer of Story of the Year went on to say something along the lines of, like I care, if I had the mic and a second chance, I'd do it again.
Okay, so if any of that is true, then that last paragraph about the pregnant lady flips the script on the story, right? That's a key part of this that was left out.
Right.
If that's true.
Because there's 2 sides to every story, and there's something a little about posting that story on the website that seemed a little... Maybe it's just the flurry...
Seems a little weird.
Maybe it's just the flurry of profanities. makes it disingenuous.
We're turning into old guys being like, listen, if you, you know, present yourself a little cleaner without the profanities. Yeah. So I wonder, okay, does Dan look at them and say, I'd do it again if I had the mic? I don't know, right? That seems ridiculous. Maybe he does. Maybe this is all posturing. I think a lot of this also is a young band who is shooting to fame over the course of about 365 days and is getting thrown into situations that, you know, when you were playing clubs with 300 people and you said, hey, come out from the back and come up by the stage so we can rock out together, that was like something you said every night, right? So, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot coming at these guys. The Godsmack guys are older. I'm sure the crew they have around them is older. They have better infrastructure. They are more professional. Well, until they start throwing punches. There's just a lot of this kind of clash of all these things, these being mixed up. But also, I do think that there is real security concern here that actually starts all this. The story of the year really downplays in all of this.
Motley Crue alert. Do we need to just say it's happening?
I think you can tell a lot on who's telling the truth based on past and future behavior.
Right.
And go ahead and read this article, because this is not the only dust-up that Godsmack has with a band that they play with.
Yeah, and I just want to say that, yeah, I'm excited I get to talk about Motley Crue for no reason whatsoever. Godsmack frontman Sully Erna has admitted that for the band's fifth studio album, The Oracle, that the CD's first single, Crying Like a Bitch... Man,
oh my God.
I've said the most offensive things in this episode, was inspired by events of the Crue Fest 2 tour, on which Godsmack appeared alongside headliners Motley Crue. Erna told Artisan, did he say that? News service at the time, there's definitely some rock star garbage on this tour that we just have never seen in our career.
Wow.
This was the first time I felt like, you know what? If there are going to be some people that are going to treat other people a certain way, then I'm going to go out there every night and make sure we make you look old and fat and go home with a nice big fat paycheck. According to Hard Drive Radio, Erna intended the song as a slam on Motley Crue bassist Nikki Sixx, although no one has yet to be officially confirmed by anybody in the Godsmack camp. By the way, Motley Crue appearing Louder Than Life here in Louisville, Kentucky.
what do you think about this story?
I probably would say it's true. I haven't, you know.
About Nikki specifically? You think Nikki is who he's talking about?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I mean, we can talk about Nikki bad behavior if you want to. Yeah. I mean,
I couldn't pass that up when I ran across that in the research. We are the story guys at gmail.com. You can support the show, patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. Share it with a friend. You can do that in several ways, wherever you listen to it. And then if you found us on YouTube and you want to share this around social media, share clips that we put up, etc., please do. It helps it build the listenership and propagate the show. We appreciate you. And until next time, what should people keep doing?
Keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.